The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast for May 4th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. It's a Monday, Jackie, and we had a really nice weekend on Saturday here in Calgary.
Yeah, it was kind of like the spring vacation I never got.
Your Mexico vacation in Calgary?
Yeah, 2 hours of sun, and then it ended. But, you know, I made sure I was out for the whole time.
Yeah. No, it was a good weekend, but we're back in the saddle over here, and we're going to talk about all sorts of cool things. But I thought we'd take us a little bit back. First of all, so where did you start your career?
I started actually here in Calgary at a software company that made a product called HiSys, 1996 or so.
No, 96. So in 1996, actually, I was just coming off being a CEO of a biotech company. I bet you didn't know that.
No, I did not know that.
So I've worn many hats in my career. And given this pandemic, I'm fully versed, or at least back in 1990s terms, in terms of immunology and so on. So following the situation very closely. But I did come back to my roots. I came back into the financial services industry. And guess what? One of the first companies that I started following as an equity analyst was Precision Drilling. And we know that the drilling industry has had its ups and downs. And you know, when I started following from a stock market perspective, writing reports about Precision Drilling and the other drillers here in the Canadian oil and gas industry, it was really around 1998. And back then, OPEC was flooding the market. The price of oil went to 10 bucks. The Economist magazine said that the price of oil was going to be $5 forever. And of course, it never was. It rebounded back and we had some of the highest prices ever in the ensuing couple of decades. But here we are again. OPEC floods the market. We've got the pandemic. Demand goes through the floor. It's the up and down cycle of our industry. And we've seen a lot of them. But you know what's going to be fun on this podcast is we've got a very special guest. Appropriately, we've got Kevin Neveu from Precision Drilling. He's the CEO, and he's going to talk to us about the current situation. So welcome, Kevin.
Good morning.
Good. So, Kevin, you're based in Houston, I understand, but you are from Canada. Could you tell everyone a little bit about your background and what brought you to be the CEO of Precision Drilling?
Sure, Jackie. So, I grew up, born and raised in Edmonton. Most of my career, though, was spent outside of Canada. You know, I joined the industry back in 1982. And, Peter, if my memory serves me correctly, sort of in that early 80s, global demand for oil was around 48 million barrels, and I think production was around 60 million barrels. So, I think we're kind of back into what we faced back in the mid-80s in Canada. But I joined an oil field rig building company back in 1982, following working with my father's rig construction company for a few years. Ended up joining Precision in 2007 as the chief executive officer and moved back to Calgary about 4 years ago as our U.S. business continued growing and we saw things in Canada slowing down. We decided to move most of the executive team of Precision back to Houston.
And you've got a lot of international operations as well, so Houston seems to be a logical place to be.
Yeah, it does. We've got rigs operating in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait. We've been active in Latin America, so Houston certainly is, from a logistics standpoint, a much easier place to get around the world for an oil service company.
Well, it'd be great to have your perspective. We have some questions to ask you today. We're going to have three broad categories. First, we're going to talk about what's happening in the oil fields of the world as a result of the pandemic from your perspective, the extent to which service industry is being decimated and its consequences, in your view, towards the future production of oil and gas. And then lastly, we want to finish on a positive, talk about some of the technology that is evolving that may help this industry become even leaner and lower emissions and cleaner in the future. So let's start maybe with the first one, Peter.
Yeah, well, I think we should just go right to basics, Kevin, and maybe just tell our listeners, those who are unfamiliar with the drilling business, like how many people typically are on a crew of a modern drilling operation? Can you describe a well site for us?
Yeah, on a drilling rig, the crew itself that operates the rig and do the drilling operation would be five or six people. And then there'd be another couple of people on location that might be the directional drilling team. And there could be a safety person on location, maybe a mud guy, a bit guy. So the entire spread on location would have anywhere from, say, 8 to 12 people at any given time. And then when you look at the fact you've got a day shift, a night shift, and then a relief shift, you kind of triple that headcount. So it's, you know, typically a rig itself, the direct labor on the rig, is usually around 40 people per rig. But at any given time, there's around 12 to 14 people on location.
And there's all sorts of support services sort of coming in and out.
That's right. You know, there'll be water hauling trucks coming in and out, cement trucks coming in and out, pipe trucks coming out.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the ancillary businesses that support the rig to keep that rig running in the field would be about another 110 to 130 people. They're operating somewhere in the background, either coming out temporarily or even just staying remote but supplying, you know, could be hotel rooms, could be food, or could be other supplies to the rig. So each rig, direct labor in the rig, around 40 to 45 people, varying times, and then another support group of around 100 to 120 people.
Yeah, so it's super consequential, obviously, when we have a downturn and you have the number of rigs being parked and, you know, it has just a multiplier effect on the employment, which is a big issue right now.
Yeah, it's a huge multiplier effect. And you have to remember, most of the rig jobs tend to be, you know, higher paying jobs because they're field-related jobs, they're 12-hour per day jobs, you know. To give you a sense of what I mean by that, just a beginning rig hand that joins precision drilling coming out of school, going through our 3D orientation, can make almost $100,000 per year if he works a full year, base plus overtime, and then the salaries go up from there.
When you think about the number of rigs in the U.S. that have been parked, right? I'm just looking at some recent numbers. They're down about 370 to 400 rigs since the beginning of March. So think of how many jobs that has impacted. And here in Canada, rigs are down. You know, traditionally, this time of year, they're down, but I think they're going to be down by half, potentially, the activity levels this year compared to last year.
Well, Jackie, right now, we're kind of hitting all-time lows in Canada. I mean, this is not just cyclic, not just seasonal, but these are all-time low activity levels. The pandemic, the economic slowdown, the low oil prices, and then, you know, preceding the most recent crisis, we've really been through almost half a decade of underinvestment in Canada. So, you know, before this COVID-19 crisis broke out, most of our customers were already in a tough spot. They're already cutting budgets and running at less than long-term averages. But you throw on top of it the oil price war, the pandemic, and the economic slowdown, and we've gone from a tough situation to, for lack of a better term, dire situation.
Yeah, and when these workers are laid off or let go, oftentimes after a downturn, they don't come back. So you're losing a lot of tacit knowledge. You know, people who understand safety, people who have a good feel for how to drill a well properly and all of that. I mean, are we thinking that this is going to do some pretty severe damage to sort of the knowledge base of drilling, not only here in Canada, but in the U.S.?
Well, Peter, I'll answer that question kind of in two parts. And the first part is I would tell you that the training that we do today for field crews is probably a couple orders of magnitude more sophisticated than it was 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. But with that also goes a much more structured development program. So, for example, to take a brand new green high school graduate like I described earlier and bring him through our initial training program, get him into what we call a white hard hat, and that's after he's gone through the initial training, the initial mentorship period, is between 6 and 9 months. So a new person coming to the rig really can't be left alone on his own for about 6 to 9 months. And then there's a series of sequences of jobs that take them through lease hand to floor hand to derrickman, motorman, and eventually driller. And it takes up to 10 years for us to develop drillers. So when we're running today 11 rigs right now today, that means I've got 11 rigs with three drillers per rig. I've got 33 active drillers in my fleet today. Even as recently as back in January when I had 70 or 80 rigs running, I would have had to have had 240 drillers. If those drillers leave the business, it'll take me a 10-year cycle to train new drillers. And that's how dire the situation is.
And in 2015 and 16, it was another difficult period where activity levels got low, not as low as what we're seeing now. Did you find that people came back to the industry as things got busy again?
They got busy, but not as busy as they were. So, you know, typically with a normal seasonal cycle, we'll lose 20 to 40% who don't come back in a seasonal downturn. With a cyclic downturn, it gets more like 50 or 60%, and that's what we saw in 2015. That was a cyclical downturn, and more than half to two-thirds didn't come back. This is much, much deeper and could be much more prolonged.
There is the chance that when things do get better, and I think they will, there's going to be a light at the end of the tunnel, that potentially staffing may be an issue for the service industry, for drillers at least. Do you think that would be the case more broadly as well?
You know, I think there are, you know, we saw challenges in the Permian Basin as recently as a year ago, trying to find something as simple as truck drivers. And if we were having this interview a year ago, a year and a half ago, we would have been talking about the staffing challenges in the Permian Basin just in a normal ramp-up, let alone recovering from a deep downturn. The short answer is, yeah, it'll be very tough to staff in the big upturn. I think scale will matter. I think larger companies with more sophisticated systems will do better. I think Alberta is quite well known for its small entrepreneurial companies to do quite well. I think they'll be the hardest hit.
So let's talk about your customers. So oil and gas companies hire drilling contractors like Precision Drilling to go drill the wells. What are the customers telling you now that we're in the middle of this deep, deep downturn? You know, maybe start with the United States and then maybe a commentary on Canadian oil and gas company customers as well.
Peter, the messages we're hearing are quite similar, you know, whether it's Permian Basin, the SCOOP/STACK in Oklahoma, or the Montney-Duvernay or the Cardium in Canada. Certainly, forward visibility is looking very poor, and they can't make commitments beyond maybe a few months. They don't know what their 2021 budgets will look like. They're not even sure what they're going to have left to spend in Q3 and Q4 this year. So it's a high degree of uncertainty. A lot of the people we deal with directly, drilling engineers and drilling managers, aren't even sure if they'll have jobs. A real dynamic situation right now.
The natural gas side of the business is starting to look a little bit better. Now, it's been very difficult. Like, for example, in the U.S. right now, there's only 85 gas rigs drilling, less than half of a year ago. Are you hearing, though, any signs that as gas prices improve, you might see more drilling near the end of the year on gas?
We made a comment in our conference call on our Q1 earnings release a few days ago that we are hearing some potential to add a handful of rigs if gas prices improve, but really a handful. You know, that could be 3 or 4, maybe 8 or 9 or 10, but I wouldn't see that being increased demand that would save the industry or provide any real respite.
Now, the situation is really quite severe, and especially, as we said, as it relates to the people who are working on the rigs that have a lot of knowledge and other people in oil field services that get laid off. Ultimately, like actually many other industries that are suffering in this pandemically induced downturn, you have a permanent impairment of a supply chain. So we know that that impairment is going to be probably quite acute here in North America. But tell us about internationally, because that matters to us as well. If the supply chains are damaged internationally, it's difficult to ramp back up after demand starts coming back. Then it's potentially a setup for higher prices because you just can't get enough skilled people to drill the wells that are needed to offset the global declines.
Well, Peter, I think that's a really good question. You know, I've been traveling to the Middle East and around the world since 1989. I've watched a number of cycles affect the international business. And typically what we see is that because you're dealing with international oil companies like IOCs or national oil companies, you generally see much longer planning cycles and much less reactive to short-term volatility. So commonly, you'd see that international rig count kind of edge up or down over 6 to 18 months by maybe plus or minus 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Canada, we cycle down 70% in spring breakup every year. But internationally, it was much, much more spread out, much longer, much more gradual. This could be different.
Well, it's interesting. The data just came out from Baker Hughes, which is a little bit more lagged for international, but they were already showing April compared to March levels were down 10%. And that surprised me because, as you say, normally there's very little reaction in the short term to the international rig count.
This could be different this time. I think with these extremely low oil prices and companies that are actually kind of locked out. So right now, you know, our customers in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia are working from home. I would say that their decision-making process is maybe a little more hierarchical than you'd find in North American companies. So it's tougher for them to make decisions when they're working remotely. As a result, it's easier to lay down rigs than it is to add rigs or develop new programs. So I would think that the lockdown probably causes a few rigs to be laid down in the short term, which is, I think, what we're seeing.
Have you seen any impact of COVID on international rigs or even here in North America, meaning that you had to shut down rigs because of COVID infections?
Yeah, so we haven't lost a rig anywhere in the world, and we haven't even recorded a COVID infection on any location in Precision anywhere globally.
But I imagine if there was, I know you're not in the offshore business, but you can imagine if the virus gets on an offshore platform or something that's fairly serious.
Yeah, I'm aware of a handful of instances globally, but I'd say that the controls and the discipline and structure in the drilling business, both offshore and onshore, is much tighter than a lot of parts of the open economy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can tell you that at Precision, we began to identify COVID risk in mid-February and began putting in place COVID mitigation techniques in late February, including travel bans and testing and screening, well before the general population did. I think most drillers were doing the same thing.
Hmm.
At the field level, I think we contained or kind of blocked the risk. But also you have to remember, most of the crew members on a rig will be in the range of, you know, 19, 20 years old up to early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just generally a less likely to get infected group.
Right. I want to get back to the idea of rebound, because of course, a lot of this depends upon the rebound of the demand side. And we've had discussions on this podcast about that before, but you know, there's some data that's indicating that the rebound in demand, especially from the commuting sector, you know, people who drive personal vehicles and cars, could come back actually quite fast. I was looking at some data in China and Beijing, and some of the congestion numbers are coming back and are actually exceeding pre-COVID levels. In other words, people are less inclined to take public transportation. And so we could have a situation here where the demand rebounds rather quickly, the oil consumption responds commensurately, it has to come out of storage because the storage tanks are filled up, all the way up the supply chain to you. You're idle for a year, year and a half. I don't know. Who knows, right? And so when the call comes for rigs, the oil and gas companies may have to compete for even rigs that are not going to be available because the crews are not available. Is that a scenario? I mean,
well, it's been a scenario in every other rebound. What you've just laid out for a scenario to rebound happens every single time.
Yeah.
You know, there's always an overreaction going down. There's always a demand reaction that surprises the supply side. There's enough industrial lag that by the time they get back to the drill bit, it's often too late.
Yep.
And now they're playing catch up and the industry plays catch up. It becomes a seller's market for rigs. You know, we think we're well positioned. This is my comment earlier about scale, being able to scale and, you know, bring crews on, train them quickly, you know, having retained more drillers will give larger scale players an advantage.
Yeah.
So I do think that there's going to be a response at some point in time, and preserving core capabilities and core training to meet that response is very important.
I'm having a bit of deja vu in my introductory monologue about my first job as an equity analyst covering Precision Drilling in 1998. And as I said, I mean, there was doom and gloom, the economist saying $5 oil forever. And then, you know, sure enough, that was the call of the bottom. And then the rapid rebound that occurred after that. I mean, I know this is different, but boy, it sure has a similar kind of feel to it.
Although, Peter, I think that we're dealing with a lot of surplus oil that could take a little longer to work out of the system than the last few cycles. Which also means, I think, that the low gets lower and the rebound gets sharper and steeper.
Yeah. Your terminology there, the industrial lag. I mean, the industrial lag, but, you know, by the time the signal goes all the way from the ignition key in a vehicle all the way through storage to the pipe to the upstream to the drilling, it could take a year and a half.
It could. So, you know, just turning to the positive for that for a moment, this is where shale oil might have a real advantage, because shale oil can be drilled in very small capital amounts and you can get production on very quickly. You could start with very small pads, 4-well pads, which you could drill probably in about 25 days and frack those wells in another, you know, 20 days. You can have oil in production within 3 months.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing is we expect the U.S. to decline in their production, so that means there should be ample takeaway capacity.
There should be. So I think that the upside for the shale plays in the U.S. and Canada, Canadian shales, even the Cardium and Viking plays on the backside of this does look quite encouraging, because you can very quickly get back into these plays. The rocks are there. The geology is proven. The technology, we'll talk about in a moment, is going to get better yet.
Yeah.
So there's no geological risk. There'll be little or no technological risk. It'll be easy, quick oil, mm-hmm. essentially de-risked.
And the equipment capacity is there, right? Like, these rigs aren't going anywhere. The people are being laid off, but the rigs are available and if they're needed.
Yeah.
And importantly, Jackie, the capital is already there. It's sunk capital in the assets. We don't need to invest a bunch in the assets.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about technology. I looked at your website and your latest investor presentation shows a lot of information around the work you're doing around data science automation, as well as a new generation of rigs. Maybe just tell us a bit about that.
Exactly. I commented earlier about the driller. The driller sits in the cabin. He controls the drilling rig and he controls the crew. But as we've drilled these wells so much faster the last few years with better drilling mud and better bits and kind of repeatable, predictable geology, the driller does a lot of redundant activities. He'll hit about 20 different buttons just to control the drilling rig while they're tripping pipe out of the ground. And it's the same 20 buttons over and over and over, maybe 300 times in 4 hours. So what we're doing is automating all those things, putting in place a bunch of algorithmic sequences that can replace all those button pushing. He can sit back and hit the trip button, and the machinery will operate itself, and he can monitor and oversee it and watch his crew. That allows us to optimize the tripping times, optimize all the sequencing connections, and lower the cost and lower the time.
For those of us in the audience that don't know the term tripping, that's pulling the pipe all the way out of the well hole, right? Well bore, right?
That's right. And I was using that as an example, but essentially the entire drilling operation in different sequences can be automated because it's all repetitive. In doing that, we can make the driller more of a machine tool observer and crew supervisor, which is what his real job was supposed to be. And we can optimize the process and probably save on the order of 10 to 15% of the well cost.
That makes me think of a question. You know, the day rate model that drillers have used has been kind of problematic, I think, from the driller's perspective, because you've gotten so efficient. For example, I think the time to drill the same well today might be less than half of what it was several years ago. If you continue to make things more efficient, doesn't it eventually kind of hurt your profitability?
Well, you know, the industry has done that right from the first day. If you go back to the history of drilling, back to the 1800s, the drilling industry drills faster all the time. So you could argue we've been drilling ourselves out of business since the very first day in 1862. But the part that's difficult is the oil companies, the E&P companies, have really never managed the risk with the service companies or the returns very well. When times are good, they're happy to give us a little bit extra. When times get tough, they have a lot of power swings to their side, and they end up throwing a lot of risk and low prices at us. It's been an imbalance kind of forever also. What I would say is they've been pretty good at letting us pay for our investments. So if we build a new rig, they'll let us pay for the new rig, and they'll sign a contract for the entire duration of that rig. I think that part works very well. So new investments have been covered. Upgrades are generally treated the same way. They'll fund the upgrade and cover that for us. What happens is once the rig gets paid for, once the upgrade's paid for, and that contract has expired, then the rig competes on the open market. And it's just supply and demand equation on price.
Okay, so they're basically saying if you're going to develop this new technology, which will make drilling times, as you say, 10 or 15% less, then I will help you capitalize that and agree to give you a certain amount of work to help pay for that. Is that?
That's right. And then once that work finishes its cycle, then you're competing in the open market. So I would say there's always been a technology arms war in drilling. You know, it started off years ago going from steam to diesel, and then diesel to electric, and then electric to top drive, and then, you know, top drive to digital. I think that arms race doesn't go away. I think that the leaders in the space, the first movers, do quite well, and I think everybody else plays catch-up, and some fail. So I don't dislike the current model. I think it is weighted unfavorably towards the E&P companies, but it always has been.
But the E&P company now has a big incentive to be efficient so that they can compete at lower and lower costs, and you effectively become a partner. So I want to get back to this notion of autopilot, and how far away are we from actually having a truly autopilot kind of system that, you know, you pull the rig up to where it's supposed to drill the well and away you go. It drills it and pulls it up, and you have the one observer instead of six people on the rig.
Yeah, I think we're a long, long ways from that. And Peter, I'd say that because the six people on the rig, most of the crew's time right now is actually spent maintaining all the machines on the rig. A drilling rig is not one machine. It's about 150 machines, including compressors, motors, pumps, drawworks, top drive. And it's all rotating machinery that has a lot of ongoing maintenance. And to automate the maintenance would be more expensive than just having a few people running around greasing and checking fluid levels. So I think we're a long ways away from push-button drilling.
So how about cost reduction? You said 15%. How much more do you think you could go down the cost curve?
This moves in different pieces. I think getting faster data from downhole, you know, whether it's wired drill pipe or some way to communicate with the drill bit to get drill bit vibrations, temperature, speed faster and sooner, might save another 15%.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking about 15% on process improvements through automation, maybe another 15% from real-time drill bit data, maybe another 10% through optimization of well bores. So you add that up, you probably cut the time in, you know, maybe in half one more time.
Well, that's pretty remarkable.
But then you get to a lot of physical limitations. You know, you run into things like Reynolds number with fluid flow, or, you know, you just can't cut chips fast enough down hole with the drill bit. You can't move the rocks out of the hole fast enough. You run into all kinds of choking problems. So I think we're getting pretty close to physical limits, but there's still some more to be gained.
For our audience perspective, like a typical well might be drilling vertically down, what, 2-3 kilometers, and then bending the pipe and going horizontal another 2-3 kilometers, right?
Yeah, maybe as much now as 5 kilometers horizontal.
Wow. But give us, let's say, a standard well total length of 4 kilometers. How long would that take to drill?
So if it's one of these, you know, shale horizontal wells that we're drilling for gas or for oil, and you're talking about 4,000 meters, that could probably be, you know, in a known field where you're drilling the same well over and over, probably drill that well in anywhere from 6 to 10 days.
6 to 10 days. I mean, it was only, what, 10 years ago. That would be 3 times that amount, right?
Yeah, it would have been probably 45 to 50 days.
Or even, yeah, four or five times. It's just amazing how, when you think about cutting through a rock, and it's not only the rock boring that's really amazing, it's also the precision with which you are positioning these drill bits, right?
We did an interesting job last summer. We drilled a geothermal loop well, and we had 2 rigs 2,500 meters apart, and the objective was to drill 1 vertical well from each rig and then have 2 laterals.
Yeah.
And the 2 laterals had to meet the other rig halfway, so 1,250 meters away, and the target was 6 5/8 in diameter, 6 5/8 of an inch in diameter, about 175 millimeters in diameter. We hit both targets at 1,500 meters.
So 1.5 kilometers, so you're basically connecting the two sides of a U-shape underground.
That's right.
Right. So you're drilling vertical, then you're bending in to make the bottom of the U, and you're connecting the hole that's only, what did you say, 175 millimeters apart. I mean, that's just remarkable that you can position it so accurately. That was actually for the Ever company that we interviewed, John Redfern, the CEO, a few months back.
I can tell you, standing on one rig, looking across the field, 2.5 kilometers to the other rig, and then holding your fingers in a circle, 6 5/8 in diameter, or 175 millimeters, try to imagine that out. At 1,250 meters was beyond comprehension.
So, yeah. Kevin, along with technology, you talked about autopilot, automating more. Back to the beginning of our conversation, we talked about the potential for people to leave the industry and have a shortage of labor, you know, 2-3 years down the line when people really want to get drilling again. Do you think that these technologies can fill the gap? Like, could they reduce the amount of time it takes to train people or have less skilled people be effective in the field?
So, Jackie, I think that's actually a great observation. What we found is that we can get drillers to be excellent drillers much faster with automation, but it still takes time to train the leadership skills. So I think the short answer is, I think that the technical skills can be assisted with technology, but I think leadership and directing the crew around, I don't think the crew size is going to decrease very much because there's so many moving parts and so much machinery. We still need to do a lot of maintenance and a lot of ongoing kind of adjustments to the machine. So I think the leadership will take long to train, but I think the technical skills we can train quickly, which should help it to rebound a little bit, but I still think there's a big challenge.
Well, however it rebounds, the industry is not going to look the same. It's going to be changed as it's always changed after we come out from a downturn. Like, can you characterize what you think the service industry, first of all, looks like, say, 5 years out from now?
So I think technology and data will play a bigger role. I think that there'll be 2 tiers of companies. There'll be large scale-based companies and then small entrepreneurial companies. I think the gap will have widened. You know, I think the mid-size Canadian driller or mid-size Canadian fracking company will have a harder time. I think there'll be capital for small startups and capital for large scale-based companies. It'll be an industrialized business where it's cheaper to run 50 frack fleets than run 5. It's cheaper to run 200 drilling rigs than run 5.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that industrial scale will matter, and that'll cause a widening between the small companies and large companies. But I think there's a place for both still, the small entrepreneur, Canadian energy services entrepreneur, and then the larger public funded low cost of capital type company.
Do you think a lot of the mid-sized service companies, do you think they would merge together, or do you think they just sort of disappear because it's such a difficult environment?
Well, I think the assets don't disappear. The companies may change. You know, and Peter, you joined the, the industry, I think you said 1996?
Well, as a financial analyst, yeah.
Right. I think if you look back 10 years earlier to 1986, the largest drilling contractor in Canada was Royal Bank of Canada through all of the restructurings that were done.
Actually, that's an interesting observation. If you go even further back into the 60s and 70s, actually, the oil and gas companies owned their own drilling rigs. It was much more of a vertically integrated company, right? Do you see that happening?
I don't see that happening. I see the oil and gas companies becoming more digital and more knowledge-based, less focused on twisting wrenches and turning drill bits.
Mm-hmm. But even that will become more automated, as we talked about earlier.
Yeah, and I think the jobs become more technical with time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which makes it better for the larger companies that can invest in the R&D to automate and become those big industrial companies.
And leverage those costs over the scale.
Yeah. Good. Well, Kevin, this has been great. Thank you for your insights and best of luck navigating through these difficult times.
Well, thank you for having me on today. Appreciate
it. Thanks a lot. That's awesome.
Yeah, we'll put a link to your website so people can learn more about your company on the show notes. And to our listeners, thanks for following our podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.